Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of April 27th, 2012. And you know what happened this week? A colleague turned the tables on me.
Tess, how much do you make?
Oh, you really think I'm going to tell you? Are you kidding me?
If I went to any American with that question, that would be the end of the interview.
But in China, conversations about money are the norm. We'll talk with our Shanghai correspondent about what it's like to know what everybody makes. And think clothes make the man? Try again.
My car is a gunmetal gray 2007 BMW 328xi. Like most other actions I undertake, its purchase was accompanied by a sense of terrible shame.
Comedian Michael Ian Black defends his financial indulgence and inspiration from those who've landed their dream job.
I have a dead-end job working as a business journalist, and I'm trying to find some inspiration.
I'm employed now, doing fake flower designs and dog walking. Living the dream-ish.
Backstage at Employee of the Month, next on Marketplace Money from APM.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We had a rare treat at Marketplace this week. Our China correspondent, Rob Schmitz, was in town in the flesh. He's been crisscrossing the country talking about his reporting on Apple's operations in China, in particular his recent visit to the Foxconn plant, where so many of Apple's products are made. And during a presentation to our staff, he mentioned all kinds of things about how Chinese people handle and manage their money. So I have dragged him into the studio to tell us about it. Welcome, Rob.
Thanks, Tess.
Nice to have you here in person.
It's good to be here finally. I can talk to you face to face.
Exactly, exactly. So while you were telling us about some of the backstory behind your Foxconn coverage, you mentioned that money is actually a very easy topic of conversation
right.
in China, which I find fascinating because that is the opposite
right.
of what it is here.
Right. You know how you do man on the street interviews here?
Yeah.
You know, that's like the curse of every cub radio reporter.
Right.
You're sent out and you have to randomly go up to strangers and ask questions about policy or public things. And,
right.
and usually in the U.S. when I do this, you'll hear the most interesting thing that's happened to somebody within the first 5 minutes or so of an interview.
Uh-huh. But when it comes to money?
When it comes to money. For example, if
How dare you ask me that? Right.
Tess, how much do you make?
Oh, you really think I'm going to tell you? Are you kidding me?
So this is a question that if I went to any American with that question, that would be the end of the interview.
Uh-huh.
However, many Chinese, unlike Americans, will not tell you a lot of their personal history right off the bat. But the interesting thing about China, as a business reporter, my job is made easier because I can just stick to the money. I can ask them, how much do you make? Oh, do you spend it? What do you spend it on? What's your budget like? Did you make this much 10 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
And they say, no, I didn't make, you know, the economy was terrible back then. Well, what was that like? And then that's where you start getting to some of these really interesting stories that you would hear right away if you were talking to an American.
So the very personal money question is the gateway to the rest of the personal history.
Exactly.
That's just hard, I think, for so many of us here in America to imagine because money is actually the taboo subject here.
Right.
What is it about the Chinese culture that makes it not a taboo there?
At one point in time, everyone was pretty much making the same, so it didn't really matter. But
is that changing now?
That is changing. And I think that the attitudes about talking about your salary are changing as well.
Hmm.
I'm noticing that in Shanghai, at least, if I ask that question to some folks might not tell me now. Because there is this widening wealth gap between the rich and the poor. I know some people who are making a lot of money, like Chinese friends who are making a lot of money.
And what are they doing with that money?
They're saving it. It's there for rainy days. Many Chinese remember a time when they didn't have anything.
Hmm.
And I think that that still weighs on them.
So is there the potential that as China becomes more of a consumer culture,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, what we're hearing,
yeah.
That saving habit
mm-hmm.
Will change because there are more things to spend on.
Well, this is something that economists are worried about, that the Chinese, in their very frugal ways, will be reluctant to consume. They won't consume as much as we did.
Hmm.
I mean, we're definitely seeing a very steady rise of consumerism in China. You're seeing that among the richest people in China, And when I say rich, I mean really, really rich. And so that's why you see Coach stores. That's why you see Lamborghini outlets. Yeah. That's why. And part of the issue for that, too, is that the Chinese aren't allowed to invest in foreign markets. And so the money really can't leave the country. And so either you have an option of saving all of this. First of all, where do you put it? If you put it in the bank, the actual inflation rate is higher than the interest rate in China. So it doesn't really make sense to put it in a bank.
And people here are struggling with that as well.
Yeah. So what do you do? Right. What do you do? So a lot of the richest Chinese are buying art. Hmm. China is sort of becoming the center of the art world. You know, it's a great investment for them. They can buy it. They can sell it later on. It's keep it in the country. They do it by the rules. So it's interesting to see.
You were also telling me about the cash economy in China and how you have to keep vast amounts of paper money around. And even you as someone who has to pay other people, you sit there and count out the money for them.
So the biggest denomination for the renminbi, for the Chinese currency, is 100 renminbi. And that's worth around 15 U.S. dollars. There is no bigger denomination. There are pink bills with the picture of Mao on them. I have stacks of these in sort of what I call the Bureau Bank. And I sort of, when I'm on payday, when I'm paying my assistant or I'm paying our cleaning lady, it sort of looks like I'm a mafia character because I've got bills all over the table. I look like a drug dealer. For example, the most interesting manifestation of this is when people buy cars. A lot of times they'll take a Samsonite suitcase full of stacks of 100 renminbi bills that are all, you know, tied together, and they'll bring it to over to the dealership, and then they'll spend, you know, half an hour counting the money through these machines, and they'll do the transaction.
So you have people just wheeling money around the city.
You do sometimes. You know, I think that this will change at some point, you know, in 10 years or so, maybe 5 years. We're not going to see that anymore. And that's actually a part of China that I think is kind of, in many ways, fun. A little dangerous because you don't want to be mugged when you've got a suitcase of like 10,000 or 20,000 U.S. dollars. But at the same time, it's one of these fun things about China that makes reporting there really an interesting time.
Well, thank you for all your reporting. And it's so great to have you back in the States, at least for a little while. Safe travels back.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And by the way, Rob's reporting included a really fascinating video from inside the Foxconn factory, and you can see that at marketplace.org. It shows, among other things, how an iPad is assembled and tested. And, you know, the iPad is the device that really dominated Apple's earnings headlines for the first quarter. And it turns out the iPhone, though, is the real moneymaker. Apple said this week it sold 35 million of them in the first 3 months of the year. And that news will be no surprise to commentator Tim Bedore.
My 14-year-old daughter Claire is absolutely rabid for an iPhone. For 2 years, she has pestered me, first out of sheer envy. Her friends had iPhones. She wanted one too. I said, no, you don't need one, and they're expensive. After months of just wanting an iPhone, not working, she tried a different tech. Dad, if we both got iPhones, we'd reduce the cost per phone. It has GPS, the internet. It'd be a big help for you on the road. She was bribing me by saying if she gets an iPhone, I get one too. I said no, but thanks for thinking of me. The phone I have works just fine. And for the 100th time, I added, iPhones are too expensive. Undaunted, Claire then petitioned 3 different aunts to join some family plan, which reduces the cost per phone even further. By that time, I was dead set against it just because she so wanted it, and especially because she was trying to wear me down through badgering. Stop asking for an iPhone, I said, or I'm going to take away your iPad, which I rationalized would help her with her homework. You know what she did do with her iPad? Make a really slick multimedia presentation on the wonders of the iPhone. Claire showed it to me when I got back from a road trip, and it was very impressive. She overcame her shyness about public speaking and delivered a professional, polished appeal on the virtues of the iPhone. At the end, this clincher, Dad, for $10, you could buy this accessory that swipes credit cards and sell more CDs after your shows to people who don't have cash. If you sold just 40 more CDs per year, that would pay for the difference in what our current cell phone plan costs. She figured out how to make one iPhone pay for hers and mine. It seems almost un-American to not reward this stroke of entrepreneurial genius. Yet, I still haven't pulled the trigger. Claire has her nose in too many screens as it is, and this is another peer group gotta have it consumers gone wild thing I don't want to give in to. But on that road trip, I did have to call home from the car so my wife could get on the internet and direct me to the venue I was not finding on my own. As Claire pointed out in her Madison Avenue presentation, I could have done that for myself with the iPhone I should get for her and for me.
Tim Medore does stand-up comedy in Minneapolis. Anyone with an investment portfolio knows this rule of thumb. If you want spice in your life, buy stocks. If you want to play it safe, bonds are the way to go. But recently, some big-name investors have been turning that rule on its head. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, looked into it.
It's one of the most basic rules of thumb in the investing world. Bonds are safer than stocks. Jim Paulson is chief investment strategist at Wells Capital Management. He explains it this way.
Typically, through time, bonds tend to have less total return volatility.
What he means is, bonds are more stable. They don't make the massive gains that stocks can make, but they rarely fall as sharply as stocks either. So when Warren Buffett says, and I quote, "Bonds should come with a warning label," I get confused. Jim?
Stocks are so under-owned relative to how much they could be owned, and bonds are so over-owned.
Paulson says people have been spooked by the bad economy and the ups and downs in the stock market. They pulled their money out and put it in a safe place, bonds, U.S. Treasuries in particular. That's kept stock prices low and pushed bond prices up. Paulson says that's a dangerous state of affairs.
When you start to grow again, people will worry less about recession and they'll instantly start worrying more about potential for inflation. And that could come out in sort of rapid upward movements in bond yields, which would mean big downside price risk in your bond holding.
Translation, as the economy recovers, investors will start worrying about inflation. To fight inflation, they'll look for better returns. They'll demand new bonds with higher interest rates. And they'll sell their old bonds big time. That's why Buffett and Paulson say bonds are risky right now. The risk is that you could find yourself in the middle of a boom economy with the stock market going through the roof, holding a bunch of bonds worth a fraction of what you paid for them just a few years before. Now, neither Paulson nor Buffett are forecasting what stocks and bonds will do over the next week, month, or year. They're simply echoing a time-honored insight in finance. When everyone owns an investment, danger lurks.
Chris Farrell is the economics editor for Marketplace. The car you drive says a lot about who you are. Or does it?
How could I possibly justify spending $42,000 on a car when I had not yet saved enough money for my children's college education? I could not. Did that stop me? It did not.
Comedian and BMW owner Michael Ian Black on Being That Guy, later on Marketplace Money from APM. And I'm joined once again in our studio by our senior producer, Patty Hirsch. Top of the morning.
Top of the morning to you, Tess. Welcome back.
Thank you.
How was your vacation?
It was lovely. Do I look rested?
You do.
Tanned,
you
look, rested, and ready?
You do. You look ready for anything.
Excellent. Well, I hope I don't look tanned because I don't do that.
Oh.
How did last week's show go? Did we get any reaction?
We got some reaction, yeah. Kind of violent reaction, I should
violent?
Say. Yeah. We had Gina Calata of the New York Times on talking about a story that she'd written for the Times last week on a number of reports that challenged our concept of food deserts.
Yeah, I heard that report, and that was kind of a follow-up from our interview with Wendell Pierce down in New Orleans, who's opening grocery stores down there because of food deserts.
That's right. And so readers were a little bit upset by Gina. Some people wrote in saying that she needed to spend some time traveling the country and living in poor neighborhoods before she made kind of judgments like that.
Oh.
But we got one letter that came in from Princeton, because Gina lives in Princeton, and she said that Princeton is itself a food desert containing just a few ice cream and candy stores.
Yeah, you know, honestly, when I heard that, that raised my eyebrows a little bit, because I don't think of Princeton as being a particularly poor area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was kind of a lot of the reaction we got. But Anna Dombrowski, who lives in Princeton, wrote in to say that there is actually a store called McCaffrey's, which is less than 2 miles from downtown and is accessible by public transit. Mm. And we got another online comment from someone called NJ School Nurse, who wrote that there's a Wild Oats grocery on Princeton Main Street.
Okay.
I should say, by the way, you know, we really like to have people, when they write in, use their full names, which is great. So Anna did that, which thanks for that. And, you know, we get a lot of online comments, but people don't use their real names there. I mean, I used NJ School Nurse's handle there, if you like, just because she was making such a specific point.
But we want to know who you are.
Yeah.
So
you know who we are, after
all. Yeah, exactly. So if you're going to make a comment, put your name on it.
Exactly.
All right?
The other, we got some other feedback about a story that we had at the top of the show, where Adrian Hill went down to a school in South Los Angeles, and she listened to a teacher who was teaching kids about financial literacy. And at one point, he was talking about the FDIC.
Right.
And there was some feedback that he kind of aired there when he was referring to the FDIC, saying that whenever a bank goes bust, that the government actually pays them. And that's actually not quite the case. I like to think of bankers as gnomes. So if you think of every bank,
you know, we've got someone else snickering here. Should we introduce her before you go into this?
Is this who is this on the line?
I have no idea.
Oh, it's Jill Schlesinger, editor at large at CBSMoneyWatch.com.
Welcome back, my dear.
I'm glad to be here. As long as I can listen to Patty and he makes me laugh, it's perfect. You guys are awesome.
Okay, well, so let's continue with bankers as gnomes.
Okay, so bankers. So if you think of the head of every bank as a gnome, like a shriveled gnome with like that nose, with warty nose and everything.
I don't think that's going to be difficult for a lot of American people right now.
So every month, those bankers have to line up outside the government house where there's this big box with FDIC written on it. And they've got to reach inside their purse and pull out a gold coin. And they've got to drop it in there. You know, oh, I've got to put a gold coin in the slot every month. And every month, each banker drops money into the FDIC box.
With an Irish accent.
Well, or Scottish, perhaps. And what happens is, if one of these bankers goes out of business, you know, if he goes to Vegas and lives it up and loses all his money, or he invests in mortgage-backed securities that he shouldn't have invested in, and
same
he goes
difference.
Bust. Right. And suddenly you go to the bank and you're like, oh my gosh, the banker's gone bust. There's no money for me. You actually can go to the government, who will reach inside that box. The government won't reach inside its own coffers. It reaches inside the FDIC box and it pays you back up to that amount, that $250,000. That is the limit on your account. So that's really how it works.
So you're paid back from money that the banks had to set aside.
Exactly. It's an insurance plan that the banks contribute to and that the government actually does not contribute to. So when people say, oh, the government's going to pay you out, it's actually not the government. It's a government-created insurance fund, if you like, that the banks actually pay into.
And it's not taxpayer money.
It's not taxpayer money, exactly.
All right. Well, I smell a whiteboard, Patty. I think you need to do a whiteboard on this.
Actually, there is one up there right now, so listeners can go and check it out and see what that's all about.
Okay, so check that out at marketplace.org. Now, Lisa in Louisville, Kentucky has a question. I believe we have her on the line. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Jill.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How about you?
Doing great. What can I do for you?
My question had to do with the fact that I don't have any retirement set aside. I'm 53, have been given a gift of about $5,000 to invest. I work for a state-funded agency through circumstances, some of which is being a single mother and having a job that doesn't pay a ton of money and having to go through what little retirement I had. I guess my question is, what do I do? And I think I'm kind of sitting out there with starting from nothing.
Okay, Lisa, this is Tess. Can you talk to us about why you weren't able to have any sort of retirement up until now, until age 53?
That might take a while.
Yeah, that's all right. We have a little bit of time. I mean, you mentioned that you were a single mom. Obviously, you had a limited income.
I made choices. I decided to do more unconventional work up until about 10 years ago so that I would have time with my son. 10 years ago, I started working in the capacity of a social worker. At the time, we did have mutual funds that we invested in through our company, and we were matched. But our funding has been majorly decreased, so we are no longer carrying that, and lost a lot of money in those.
Uh-huh.
Well, also, our salaries have been cut, so wow. I'm no longer able to put into that, and I've had to take any money that I had in there out just to make my bills. And
oh, so you took money out of your retirement fund?
Yes, I did.
It's a very common story. I mean, obviously, in the downturn, in this great recession, just vaporized people's retirement funds. It's really your first of all, so you're not alone. You know, you're 53, and thank goodness you sound very young and healthy, and you're working. And with this $5,000, I think that assuming you don't have any debt that's outstanding, is there any crazy credit card debt or something
nope,
that's floating
nope,
around
no
out
debt.
There?
Good for you.
Which is awesome. Okay. And so, yeah, I think that having a little bit of an emergency reserve fund will prevent you from going into debt. And you know, I'm also going to assume that you are going to put one foot in front of the other and you're going to have that emergency fund set up. And then the next thing that you probably are going to do if you don't have a retirement plan through work is you would probably open up a Roth IRA.
Okay.
And you could do a regular IRA or a Roth IRA. There are a bunch of different calculators to see, but it may actually just be easier for you to do a Roth IRA. Given what the story you're telling right now.
Right, right. And I do not expect things to stay as they are. I mean, I'm not all doom and gloom and that type of thing. I'm really just kind of questioning, you know, where do I go from this point? And hopefully that's going to improve. And then what do I do?
And Lisa, do you have the ability to start setting a little bit aside every month?
Sure.
Yeah, okay.
Not a lot.
Hey, you know what? It doesn't matter. Just start with what you can. That's
uh-huh.
really the message that we try to get across. If it's $10 a month, if it's $50, if it's $150, whatever you can do.
Jill,
right.
if Lisa is seeding these two things, she's seeding an emergency fund and saving and also seeding her retirement account, which should she prioritize? Should she look to try and build an emergency fund up to a certain level before she starts putting money into the IRA, or should she do it the other way around or simultaneously?
I would actually say that the emergency reserve is the priority, because if something bad happened, Lisa, you know, if you were to lose your job, you would want to fall back on something, and we wouldn't want it to necessarily be a retirement account. We want it to be like a boring savings checking CD money market kind of account. And I would say that as soon as you got 6 months of your expenses that's safe in a boring emergency reserve fund, that you could then start adding in some sort of retirement fund, an IRA or a Roth IRA. And again, if you can go to a place that is cheap, you know, Vanguard or Fidelity or T. Rowe Price or Charles Schwab, and you can just go and choose maybe just one fund. There are a lot of these mm-hmm. funds called target retirement funds. They're really cheap to own, and use one fund and start being diligent. As Tess said, $50 a month, whatever you can scrounge up, and start to put that money away. More importantly, it's about the habit. And as you really find your situation improving, you'll add a little bit more. And you know, funny thing is, once you're done seeding that emergency reserve fund, now you can take all of that money and start putting it towards your retirement.
So I hope that's been of some help to you, Lisa?
Yes, it has. I mean, you all realize the Kentucky Derby is running in 2 weeks. So
right.
I'm contemplating putting that $5,000 on that really nice-looking white horse.
Don't do that.
Well, either that or a really nice-looking beautiful hat.
Oh, what? What is it, hats and shoes? What's going on?
Well, thanks so much for the call, Lisa. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Jill.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, Patty.
It's always a pleasure, Tess. Thank you for coming back from vacation.
You know, I thought about not doing that, but...
I don't believe that. You wouldn't desert the listeners.
No, of course not. I missed everybody. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
We spend a lot of time wringing our hands over consumerism in this country, the constant chase for status symbols, the acquisition of things. On the other hand, if we all just stopped buying things, our economy would come to a standstill. Good thing we have people like comedian and actor Michael Ian Black to save us from such a destiny.
I am a demographic. My car is a gunmetal gray 2007 BMW 328xi. And it's the fanciest thing I have ever bought myself. Like most other actions I undertake, its purchase was accompanied by a sense of terrible shame.
The first and most obvious reason for my shame was the financial indulgence. How could I possibly justify spending $42,000 on a car when I had not yet saved enough money for my children's college education? I could not. Did that stop me? It did not. The second, deeper level of shame had to do with my own sense of self. I just never envisioned myself being the kind of guy who would drive a car like that, because there is a type of guy who drives an expensive, finely tuned Bavarian automobile. That type of guy is commonly referred to as a douchebag. Compounding my shame is the fact that I already own two perfectly good cars. Yes, they are getting old, but both remain operable. The first is a hulking Jeep Grand Cherokee that we bought before people cared about the earth. The second is my Volkswagen New Beetle, purchased because my wife, Martha, thought it was cute. Originally, the car was hers, but now that we have two kids, it has become mine. I have never felt as defensive about a possession as I do about that Beetle. It's not a girl's car, I tell people. They don't even have to suggest otherwise for me to tell them this. I say it reflexively. Sometimes I say it when giving my order at the McDonald's drive-thru. Can I take your order? It's not a girl's car. But it is a girl's car. Moreover, it is a young girl's car. It is the Justin Bieber of automobiles. It's like driving around in a copy of 17 magazine. When you honk the horn, it squeals. It's simply not an appropriate vehicle for a fully grown, ruggedly handsome man such as myself. I need a sexier car, a man's car. I need a BMW. Deciding to buy the car is like getting into a hot bath after deliberately subjecting myself to the cold for as long as I could stand it. For years, I have identified myself as somebody who lives outside the demands of commerce. I became that perpetually teenage artist dancing on taxicab roofs. But what I never realized until this moment is that not only am I currently a demographic, I always was one. The iconoclast is as well-defined a demographic as the yuppie and the soccer mom and the redneck. We are all demographics. Even guys like me who do everything in our power to self-identify as different. In fact, the BMW 328 XI is specifically marketed to people who think of themselves in exactly this way. Marketers have thought of everything. They knew I would want this car before I even knew. Which is to say, they know me better than I know myself. Some people might find that creepy. I find it comforting. Because not only do they know me, they like me. They like anyone who steps into a BMW showroom, all of us craving the aggressive, masculine, deeply meaningful lifestyle embodied by these handsome automobiles with their taut steering. They know us because their only mission in life is to satisfy these deep American cravings that resonate across the vastness of our culture like whale songs. I call every BMW dealer within a 50-mile radius to ask for their best deal. I tell them exactly how I want my new Beamer tricked out. Yes, I want heated seats and GPS. No, I don't want the sport package because the online forums tell me it's a ripoff, even for kite surfers such as my future self. After a dozen calls, I manage to get the price knocked down a few thousand dollars. I order my car. They tell me 2 months. To make the long wait for the car more tolerable, BMW has thoughtfully created a website where I can check the progress of my car from its assemblage by wood nymphs in the Bavarian forests to its transatlantic voyage on the QE2 through its final transport to my dealership, borne on the wings of angels. 2 months later, as promised, it arrives. Martha drives me to the dealership to pick it up. I'll meet you at home, she says. Yes, good. Let us meet at home sometime in the future. Right now, I need some alone time with the car. I spend the first 20 minutes of our time together just admiring how good I look in it. My God, I am handsome in this car. Picture a cowboy riding a bucking great white shark. That's pretty much how I look. On the drive home, I dawdle at stoplights, waiting for panties to be thrown at me through my open window. I careen through narrow turns on the country roads near my home at speeds marginally higher than the posted speed limit. I am James Dean. I love my new car. I park it in conspicuous places. I go to the car wash all the time. One time, I buy and use an aerosol can of hubcap cleaner. With time, however, my excitement over the new car diminishes. The kids inject irretrievable food morsels into the rear seat folds. The creamy leather becomes stained from my blue jeans. The fuel consumption is a bit on the greedy side. Then, several thousand miles later, something wonderful happens. It's a small thing. While I am driving one day, the built-in video monitor on my dashboard informs me the oil needs to be changed. I like the way it tells me this. The oil needs to be changed, not you need to change the oil. The distinction is subtle but important. The car knows I am incapable of changing the oil myself and does not judge me for it. My BMW loves me despite my ignorance. It does not care that I'm a flawed driver, that I often take turns too wide and occasionally stall out on steep hills. The car likes me for who I am. Just a guy, pretty much like millions of other guys. In fact, she tells me how much she likes me each time I push her little start button. Not with words, but with the smooth purr of her engine. You are just like everybody else, she tells me, as we glide down the interstate. Just like everybody else. I find the thought oddly comforting. All of us speeding toward the same destinations, singing along to the same old songs on the radio, tumbling the same quiet thoughts over and over in our minds. None of us better than the other, all of us the same. Except that I have a nicer car.
Actor Michael Ian Black reading from his book, You're Not Doing It Right. Finding the job of your dreams can be a challenge, but when it happens, life is never the same.
The first commercial I got, I actually crashed the audition. I had nothing to do all day, and I was hanging around with a friend, and he got a call, and we both got cast. I made $37,000 on an accident job.
On stage at Employee of the Month, coming up on Marketplace Money from 8 p.m. Our studios here at Marketplace are just a few miles from the corner of Florence and Normandy Avenues, where Rodney King was beaten by LAPD officers 20 years ago this weekend. Their acquittal, of course, was the flashpoint for riots that spread throughout the city and destroyed lives and property. Billions of dollars have poured into South Central LA in the years since, but the neighborhood continues to struggle. We asked one longtime resident and local entrepreneur what's changed and what hasn't.
My name is Everett Courtney. I live in Los Angeles, California. I moved to South L.A. around 1975, and I've been here ever since. The rebuilding has been going on quite well. We do have the Crenshaw Mall that has opened since the L.A. riot. We do have a number of different developments. However, I think it's been slow coming. Things have been slow, and in particular when it comes to hiring the members of the community. But, I think it has gotten better, but I think there's yet more need to be done. We either need more collaboration or we need a shift in ownership of the businesses. I know when I first moved to Los Angeles, majority of the liquor stores, the nail salons, the gas stations, a lot of these small businesses were predominantly owned by African Americans, but there's been a shift in ownership now. I'm not saying that the people that own the businesses have to be black per se, but I feel as though that the people they run the business, that they should at least hire the kids or the people that are in the community to create a stronger bond in the community. The community would be a lot more stable if there wasn't so much transient opportunities going around with people moving in and out of the community. In order for the community to be strong and strive and survive, that when you have the same members, coming in and working and everybody working together for a common goal, then, things get taken care of a lot faster. I actually loved living here in South L.A. When the riots came about, I thought about leaving L.A. and going to someplace else. But I said, you know, in order for me to be a positive in the community, change starts with me. So I looked at things where either I'm going to either be the solution or I'm going to be the problem. And if I sit back and don't do nothing, then I'm part of the problem. So I decided to stay in South L.A. and work with a lot of the organizations here and to do my part to bring about change in a significant way that's going to uplift the community and also where a lot of the members that are on a negative path can see somebody positive doing some constructive things and make some changes in the right direction.
We keep hearing that the economy won't fully recover until the housing market sorts itself out. Well, the latest is that home prices fell to yet another new low in February. That's according to the Case-Shiller Index out this week. Lots of buyers are waiting on the sidelines for the day that prices bottom out, even though we won't know when that happens until after it happens. And because people aren't buying, rents are going up. So in that case, why not buy? Well, the Wall Street Journal's Jane Hodges digs into that debate in her new book, Rent Versus Own. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
What it really comes down to is that this is so much more than just plugging your numbers into a calculator and figuring out, you know, whether renting or buying would be best for you. But that does seem to be kind of one of the first things that people do. Is that even worth it? Is that helpful? What kinds of resources should folks be looking at to make that initial decision?
Playing with the calculators is helpful, but what people tend to do when they become interested in owning is they go shopping. They treat it like a consumer purchase. They go to open houses or they have a friend who bought and they like that person's house. Then they make a cursory stop by the mortgage brokers to see if they can get a loan. I would suggest that they start with a budget and then shop within it instead of start with, you know, kind of a dream kitchen and an emotional response to property.
Oh, but it's so fun to walk around those houses and say,
it is.
You know, we could add on another $5,000 to our purchase price. We really could. It's okay.
We really could.
So is there a general rule for when renting is just plain better?
I think if people aren't able to say, I'm definitely going to be in this job or this city in 12 months or 18 months, it doesn't really make sense to own. In my book, I interviewed a lady in Houston who went through a big rent increase. Her rent had been $1,000. It went up $100. And she'd saved a lot of money and had been thinking of buying for years. So that was her tipping point. But what she bought was a home with a similar monthly payment. And yet it had all these fees because it was new construction. And that didn't bother her at all. These were not tax deductible things that she could really play with as a homeowner. If she really wanted to own, great. But if her tipping point was the $100 extra on my rent versus $600 extra a month to be an owner and say I'm no longer renting, there's weird logic that starts to go on. People rationalize because they're owning something and it does have a bit of a savings component.
Is there anything wrong with that? I think that gets to the whole notion of what we think about home ownership.
There's nothing really wrong with that rationalizing, except in as much as when you're shopping for a home, you start to rationalize that you can spend more than is perhaps wise,
right?
Because you start to think of these investment factors that owning conveys. There is the theory that it's a forced savings plan. There is the idea if you have some equity and you stay a while, when you sell, you'll get a big chunk of money back. So people conflate the emotional purchase of owning with this sort of fuzzy idea that owning has an investment and financial function, which it does. It's just that that financial function is perhaps not as sexy as they think, but they'll use it to rationalize paying more than they should.
Is there a happy medium where it can be, yes, an investment, but also hopefully mostly just the place where you want to live?
I would say that if you're thinking of buying a home and you want to enjoy it, but you also want to protect yourself financially, that you learn to think of your home kind of as a business and be aware that when you make a repair, that isn't an improvement. So if an appliance goes and you get a new appliance, that's not adding value to your home. That's just keeping it up. Also be aware that remodeling doesn't always add value. So if you're remodeling, do it for you. And if you get some payback later, that's a bonus. Just don't bet on it.
The book is Rent Versus Own, a Real Estate Reality Check for Navigating Booms, Busts, and Bad Advice. And the author is Jane Hodges. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
The monthly jobs report comes out at the end of this week. Don't ask Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke for a forecast. He peered into his crystal ball this week and pronounced it too cloudy to call. But our employment doldrums are providing fodder for the funny among us. Jokes on Leno, Letterman, SNL. And in New York, a sketch comedy show called Employee of the Month. Josh Rogerson went for an interview.
Backstage at the Upright Citizens Brigade, in the basement of a grocery store in Manhattan, writer and comedian Katie Lazarus is gearing up for the latest installment of her show, Employee of the Month.
I'm Katie. It's very nice to meet you.
It's a live on-stage interview show where people talk about landing their dream jobs. It all started about 3 years ago, when Katie was laid off from her gig as an animation writer. She was piecing together a living, writing articles, hosting a web series, but everything was short-term. Other opportunities fell through, like being offered a writing assistant gig for a major motion picture. She also wrote a pilot that never got off the ground.
And I couldn't get job interviews, but I found that I could get informational interviews. So I decided to share these interviews with other people. I want to know about jobs. That's where we spend the majority of our time. So why not hear from people who've made it so that they really enjoy that time?
So last year, she worked her contacts to create a show on landing that perfect job.
Being unemployed is such a difficult and isolating experience. And so I did want this show to be a place where people could come together.
My name is Hanny, and I'm from London. I have a dead-end job working as a business journalist, and I'm trying to find some inspiration.
I actually heard about this show while checking my email at work.
I'm employed now, doing fake flower designs and dog walking. Living the dream-ish.
The show is a labor of love for Katie. She barely makes enough money to break even. Audible.com is a sponsor, and that helps her pay the band. There's a $5 admission price, but the theater takes 100%. During the show, she passes around a can for donations.
Ladies and gentlemen, they're coming out to the UCB Theater, and the show will begin in just a few moments.
Welcome to the stage, your hostess with the mostest, the employee that deserves all the bonuses, Ms. Katie Lazarus!
75 people squeeze into the black box space with scuffed floors and a crackling sound system. The show's sold out. It's not long before commercial actor Paul Marcarelli takes the stage.
The first commercial I got, I actually crashed the audition. I had nothing to do all day, and I was hanging around with a friend, and he got a call. And we both got cast in this commercial, and it ran for 2 years. I made a fortune, and I didn't.
Tell us about that, because I like to live vicariously.
Oh, it was so great. It was like
no, exactly. How much?
Yeah, no, I remember exactly. Yeah, I made $37,000 on an accident job.
He continued as a successful commercial actor until his big break.
Can you hear me now? Good.
Can you hear me now?
You guessed it, Paul. Is the Verizon guy. And that gig has enabled him to pursue his other passion, screenwriting.
With Paul, he came in with such a professionalism to his job. He still does. And then he used those resources. He acknowledged that he had them and he used them to produce the art he loves. So one for them, one for me.
What do you hope that your audience gets from coming to your shows or listening to your podcast?
I hope that they are inspired to finish the novel that they're working on, keep their day job if they have one. Just now that I'm older, I'm advising people to do that. But that they get inspired to continue on their path or figure out what it is they want to do when they grow up, even if they're already very grown up technically.
Katie's day job is part-time, writing for kids. She's hoping Employee of the Month will help her score her dream job of becoming a successful writer and comedian. In New York, I'm Josh Rogerson for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com. It's been raining this week here in the Southland, and that is a problem for lots of Angelenos. It means slow freeways, collisions that make you late to work, breathless reporting on the TV. There's water falling from the sky. But you know what? I don't care. I love it, in fact, because rain makes my garden grow. Now, mostly I do flowers and trees and the like, but I do have some grape tomato vines that are about to yield and several herbs. But, you know, I do know that a garden can be a great way to save money. So Meg Favreau of wisebread.com is back with some advice on how to get started. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Tess. Happy to be back.
I wanted to bring you in as we see the first shoots of spring coming up out of the ground. It's gardening weather.
It is gardening weather, but I don't think that means that you should be gardening.
You
necessarily
don't. All right. Well, we're going to talk specifically because we are doing the whole frugal tip thing here about planting veggies and herbs and things like that. Not necessarily roses, right?
Right.
Or trees.
Yeah.
things that you can eat
yes.
from your backyard.
Don't get me wrong. Like, gardening is great. I love gardening. And gardening can be a very good way to grow your own fresh food really mm-hmm. cheap. But if you go about it wrong, you're going to end up spending a lot more money than you would to just buy that food at the grocery store or at the farmer's market or wherever else you shop.
Exactly. All right. So what's the best way to get started?
If you've never gardened before and you're nervous about it, I suggest starting with a small container garden, just things in pots. They can be inside or outside, and growing fresh herbs.
Hmm.
Because a lot of herbs are pretty hardy,
yep.
and that's something that's relatively inexpensive and replacing something that's generally very expensive
exactly.
at the grocery store.
It is expensive at the grocery store.
Often, you know, like if you buy a fresh basil plant,
right.
it's going to be the same amount of money you'd spend for that big bunch of fresh basil at the store, and it's as long as you don't kill it, it's going to keep going indefinitely.
Well, that would be the caveat for pretty much everything
really,
we're talking
yes,
about, right?
I suppose so.
Are there herbs that are hardier than others that are easier not to kill?
Chives are great. I actually, for years, I had a chive plant that was a cutting of the chive plant that my mom had had since I was born that
really?
She had gotten from someone. Basil is usually pretty good. Oregano, sage. If you want to start a vegetable garden, first of all, like, great. Like, I don't mean to give the impression that I am not for gardening. But
there's nothing tastier.
Oh, my God.
And nothing more awesome than going out into the backyard and picking something and cooking it.
Yeah. For a while, I had this great garden where in the summer I could just go out and build a salad by picking off of the different plants and putting it into a bowl.
Oh.
The vegetables I would recommend the most, especially for beginning gardeners, are vine plants, your zucchini, your cucumbers, like even your pumpkins. Even if you just plant one little bunch of seeds, mm-hmm. it will shoot up and grow everywhere. And I mean, I feel like most of us know that person who has a zucchini plant.
Oh, yeah.
And they just they didn't know how to prepare for it. And they're just like offloading zucchini throughout the summer.
All right. Who should not be starting a garden?
If you cannot keep your house clean, I would recommend not starting a big garden. I'm a messy person. I say this as a messy person, and so this is not a judgment call. But if you do not regularly pick up around your own space,
mm-hmm.
why are you going to go out and clean your garden and weed it?
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, you've been great about giving us some recipes whenever we talk about food.
Yes.
So perhaps we could have one of those on our website.
Definitely.
Perhaps zucchini or pumpkin, something along
yeah,
those lines.
Yeah, I will send you something wonderful that comes from something easily grown.
Perfect. Meg Favreau of wisebread.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Tess.
And finally to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to, well, you know what? Before we get to that, I asked our friends on Facebook this week to tell me why they deserved a pig. Sean Capshaw said, quote, because I love bacon. Jason Miller, starting when he was about 8, took the cookies his mom made and traded them at school for quarters that eventually bought Nintendo games. Sally Gilbride nominated her aunt, who takes all the money she saves from coupons and puts it into a pay me account. I love these stories. It was so hard to choose this week. But our winner is Chris Keller of Bozeman, Montana. Oh, man, what don't I deserve a pig for? She asked. For living in an 11 by 17 studio to pay off my debt? for getting many of my hard goods for free from the dumpster, for living in a school bus for years in the 90s so I could keep my dog and have affordable housing, for having that rainy day bank account. Yes, for all of that, Chris, you get a pig. Facebook submissions from this week will stay in the running for future awards. And by the way, our little blue plastic friend is now on Twitter. You can follow him at Piggy Award. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Like us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, we've got your guide to buying a great and affordable bottle of wine.
Wine that is slutty is kind of all up in your face. But you want to marry the sexy. You know, sexy wine is the girl next door wine. It's subtle, yet pretty. I'm so glad we're not on TV because my face is just like a tomato head right now.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Joel Patterson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace general manager is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week. This is APM.